Right, we ended our previous lesson at Malachi chapter 2, verse 11, when we were dealing with the issue of forbidden intermarriage between the Jews and Gentile foreigners. And while this was directed mostly towards the Levite priests, it included the common Jewish population who did the same. Now, whether it was the laxity of the priests first, having the intermarriages such that the people followed by observing and doing the same, or the general population doing it first and the priests observing and then adopting the practice themselves, we don't know. What we do know is that this intermarriage issue had always loomed large in Israel from its earliest inception as a set-apart nation, and right on into New Testament times. That as well as the matter of fornication of Hebrew men with foreign women, many of them being prostitutes, it was a Torah law that Israelites were not to intermarry with foreign women. Nonetheless, it happened with alarming regularity. Paul, post-Yeshua, approached the matter from a bit different angle. In 1 Corinthians 6, starting at verse 16, "Don't you know that a man who joins himself to a prostitute becomes physically one with her? For the Tanakh says the two will become one flesh, but the person who is joined to the Lord is one spirit. Run from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the fornicator sins against his own body. Or don't you know that your body is a temple for the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, who lives inside you, whom you receive from God? And the fact is, you don't belong to yourselves, for you were bought with a price. So use your bodies to glorify God." Now compare this to Malachi 2:11. Judah has broken faith. An abomination has been committed in Israel and Jerusalem, for Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh, which he loves, by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. See, in Malachi 2:11, we read, "For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh," and then explains how they profaned it, by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. Now, one, of course, asks, assuming that the phrase sanctuary of God means the temple, then how does marriage affect the temple sanctuary one way or another? The answer is, Malachi is equating the God worshipers of Israel with the sanctuary of Yahweh in the same way Paul is equating believers as that same sanctuary, only he uses the term temple instead. Both times, the temple is being used as simile with which to compare people to a building. In neither case is God meaning the people are the temple or the sanctuary. See, the common people in the Israelite religious establishment understood that rather simple literary feature, but Constantinian Christianity has ignored it and instead attempted to use it literally in order to advance the church's foundational faith pillar that all things Israel have been replaced by all things Gentile. The point is, as concerns Israel, God is a husband to Israel. So Israel is committing adultery by Jewish men marrying foreign women. And for believers in Yeshua to have sex with or to marry a non-believer is to join together a sanctuary of God, our bodies, with a sanctuary of a false god, the believer or the body of a non-believer. So, Paul's just echoing Malachi even using the same simile, but in a slightly different way. Well, let's reread a portion of Malachi chapter 2. We'll read Malachi chapter 2 starting at verse 11 and move on towards the end. Judah has broken faith. An abomination has been committed in Israel and Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Adonai, which he loves, by marrying the daughter of a foreign god. If a man does this and presents an offering to Adonai, say, oh, may Adonai cut him off from the tents of Jacob, whether initiator or follower. Here is something else you do. You cover Adonai's altar with tears, with weeping, with sighing, as he no longer looks at the offering or receives your gift with favor. Nevertheless, you ask, well, why is this? Because Adonai is witness between you and the wife of your youth that you have broken faith with her, though she is your companion, your wife by covenant. And hasn't he made them one flesh in order to have spiritual blood relatives? For what the one flesh seeks is a seed from God. Therefore, take heed to your spirit. Don't break faith with the wife of your youth. For I hate divorce, says Adonai, the God of Israel, and him who covers his clothing with violence, says Adonai Zevaot. Therefore, take heed to your spirit and don't break faith. You have wearied Adonai with your words, yet you ask, how have we wearied him? By saying that anyone who does wrong is good from Adonai's perspective and that he is delighted with them. Or by asking, well, where is the God of justice? Now, since the Torah law that prohibits a man from marrying a foreign woman, then if he does so anyway, there is a corresponding punishment. Verse 12 explains the punishment. If a man does this and presents an offering to Yehovah Zebaot, may Yehovah cut him off from the tents of Jacob, whether initiator or follower. Now, the complete Jewish Bible rearranges this verse in a way that perhaps makes it easier to understand, but I think is a less than satisfactory way to do so. And in fact, it's unnecessary. Here's what it says more literally in the Young's literal translation. Cut off doth Jehovah, the man who doth it, tempter and tempted, from the tents of Jacob, even he who is bringing nigh a present to Jehovah of hosts. Let's approach it from the YLT version. Cut off is karet in Hebrew. This is a very severe term that in its most typical sense means to blot out the existence and memory of the wicked person along with the ending of his family bloodline. So here is a definitive case of immediate family as well as future descendants bearing a punishment for the sins of an ancestor. It can even be a case where there will be no descendants as a result of the punishment, so those who may have been born and lived will never be born in the first place. The horror of such a thought to the ancient peoples was the stuff of nightmares. But English language Bibles tend to water it down by saying, excommunicated or banished or some such thing, milder thing. Now, as we move further into the verse, most English Bibles will say something similar to the complete Jewish Bible, like, may Jehovah cut him off. May, of course, sounds like the hope of a human wishing that that bad person would be cut off. Or in other versions, it is that Yehovah may cut off that person, which to English speakers means God might or might not to decide to. The correct understanding is God will do this. See, doth expresses the proper idea of inevitability with no chance of a different outcome. And that is exactly what's intended. Okay. Notice that the threat is directed to the man that does this. The Hebrew word is ish. And while it can mean male or husband, the point is it's gender-oriented. Okay. It speaks not of mankind, male and female together, only biological males. So it is highlighted that the intermarriage issue is directed at Israelite men marrying foreign women, and less so Israelite females marrying foreign males. See, there are societal reasons for this, starting with divorce laws of the universally male-dominated societies in Bible times. But then we get this strange phrase regarding who exactly will get punished. The older and more traditional English translations say, him that calleth and him that answereth, or any to witness or answer. Another longstanding translation is everyone who awakens and answers. Frankly, those translations are so cryptic as to be gibberish. Modern-day experts in biblical Hebrew see this as an idiomatic expression, since otherwise it makes little sense. Perhaps it is some well-understood cultural phrase associated with everyday life in the community. So while we can't be 100% certain of its meaning, considering the context, it most likely is intending to implicate those who actually commit intermarriage and those who are accepting or facilitating of it. And in both cases, this would mean Israelite men, more specifically in Malachi, Jews. Now we next get a further clarification about those that will be cut off for such a violation. It says, from the tents of Jacob. See, this not only confirms that this concerns Israelite males, but that they will be disassociated from their Israelite heritage. Recall that the terms Jacob and Israel are synonymous. The phrase tents of Jacob isn't meaning for the reader to recall Israel's nomadic time in the wilderness. Rather, it is a common expression that means your home, your community. And the verse culminates with the words, he who is bringing an offering to Yehovah Zevaot. Now, some believe this is intended then to direct us to thinking that this verse is speaking to the priesthood. However, this can just as easily be speaking of individual common folks, bringing their offerings and sacrifices to the temple. Now, I lean towards this intending to implicate the priesthood, since the first part of the verse implicates all Israelite males in general. In other words, the goal is to tie all Israelite males together, common men and priests, as a group from which the abomination of intermarriage is occurring. It's a most sad state of affairs. Now, I think it needs to be said that, of course, the underlying principle applies to modern-day believers in Yeshua. Men, we should avoid marrying non-believing women, and especially if that non-believer is an out-and-out atheist. It is my opinion that in the first case, marrying a non-believer who may at least acknowledge that there is a God is less a sin, more a matter of turning a deaf ear to the crying out of wisdom not to do so. But in the second case of marrying an atheist, it is indeed a sin. What is more, sadly, the religious leadership of our day is every bit as complicit in this matter as the lay people, as well as in the commission of other sexual sins that almost always accompany it. You know, it's long been known that the divorce rate among the clergy and the moral failures for the religious leadership pretty much mirror that of their congregations. And their congregations pretty much mirror that of secular society. This is the same general condition of the Jews in Yehud in the days of Malachi. Malachi 2:13. Here's something else you do. You cover Yehovah's altar with tears, with weeping, and with sighing because he no longer looks at the offering or receives your gift with favor. Once again, let's turn to Young's literal translation to get a more accurate sense of what's happening here. And this second time ye do, covering with tears the altar of Jehovah, with weeping and groaning, because there is no more turning into the present or receiving a pleasing thing from your hand. See, the order of a Hebrew sentence is much like the order of an English sentence in that what comes first in a sentence carries greater weight than what comes second or later. The first words in Hebrew are Wezo Shenit Ta Asu. The way or ve is a conjunction that connects two organically intertwined circumstances. Thus, this verse is a continuation of, it connects the indictment of the previous couple of verses with a new one. And the previous indictment was intermarriage. We can extend this to a degree to include marriage in general, which is now connected to the issue of divorce. The Hebrew zot, which just essentially means this, is given in a form that indicates a weighty matter. The next word, shenit, means second, with the issue of marriage to pagans in the previous couple of verses being the first thing. So the idea being expressed is that the second trespass against God, divorce, is the nearly inevitable consequence of the first thing, intermarriage with pagans. And the second thing that is not yet precisely named, divorce, is alluded to with the covering of Yehovah's altar with tears and weeping and groaning. See, now the thing to understand is that the divorce being spoken of is of Hebrew women married to Hebrew husbands. So Hebrew men divorcing their Hebrew wives in order to marry pagan women. Israelite men didn't need anyone's permission, nor was there some long process to divorce. Mostly, it was only a matter of a man unilaterally announcing it and sending his wife away. It happened fast, happened frivolously, and for the worst possible reasons. The results were often catastrophic for the women. Divorced women were usually viewed as shamed and damaged. That made it difficult for them to get accepted back into their father's household to be cared for, and the usual result was poverty. Now, the grammar used in this verse expresses this intensity of the tears and the groaning of these abandoned Hebrew wives, which are at least as much about the poor futures for them that lay ahead, as much as the agony of losing the love of their husbands, and how zealously they sought God. Thus, their tears fell on God's altar. Now, let me mention as well that the exact phrase used here, which is mitzvah Yehovah, which translates best to Yehovah's altar or the altar of Yehovah, the point is this is an expression. It's not normally found outside of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. That is, it is outside the Torah, meaning outside the speech about the covenant. Now, I mention this because it's further evidence that Malachi was likely a former priest whom God had called out of the priesthood to be his prophet. His knowledge is easy speaking in covenant terminology just keeps leading me to think he had to have at one time been a Levite priest. Well, the last half of verse 13 explains the cause of all this pain. It is because Yehovah will not receive their offerings and sacrifices that relieves his anger towards their husbands and also gives the family favor and blessing. What then do these divorced women want? Well, they want God to return to them and return to showing them favor, probably by getting their husbands to reverse course. But just under the words lies this sense that Israel must return to sincere worship first. Otherwise, God will not react by returning to the type of comforting behavior that these Jews hope will happen just because it used to happen. Malachi 2:14, nevertheless, you ask, why is this? Because Yehovah is witness between you and the wife of your youth, that you have broken faith with her, though she is your companion, your wife by covenant. See, verse 14 continues with this conversational style of dialogue. And it has the people responding as though they remain puzzled at why Yehovah has removed his blessings and presence from them. Why don't you pay attention to us, accept our sacrifices any longer, they ask. That is, it is not unlike the way a teen responds after they've done something ridiculously irresponsible, have been assigned their punishment, but then in a tone that's more of a demand than a questioning of your sanity asks you, why are you doing this to me? What could I have possibly done wrong? Now, while it might sound like genuine shock and disbelief, it's anything but. From Israel's standpoint, they are saying, but I brought you all these wonderful gifts and sacrifices. So what difference does it make what I've done apart from that? It's sort of the ancient version of falling back on the belief of once saved, always saved. But God, why am I suffering these things? Why won't you hear my prayers and pleas? After all, I did go forward and pray the sinner's prayer. I tell people I believe in Jesus. So what difference does it make what I've done apart from that? See, the deal is, I live my life as I see fit, and you forgive me for whatever I do wrong. Such a deal. The Jews of Malachi's day thought their lack of sincerity and lack of obedience, it didn't matter, so long as they mechanically brought gifts and sacrifices to the altar. I mean, goodness, that was really the great thing about being a Jew in the first place. And so many believers think exactly the same way. I mean, where do you suppose those ancient Jews and these modern Christians get such an idea? Saw it by example. Heard it from their religious leadership. But then, when the consequences of their evil behavior and their bankrupt beliefs finally happened and God pulled back for them, they were in disbelief, certain that whatever the cause was, it sure couldn't have been anything they did. I mean, after all, they had a get-out-of-jail-free card. So why was it being rejected? In the case of verse 14, the response to why is this, asked by the shocked Israelites, the answer given is because God was the guarantor of the covenant made between the Hebrew wife you married when you were young, and it is you that broke the covenant with her by divorcing her to marry a woman who worships a foreign god. Covenant, covenant, covenant. It's always about the covenant. See, marriage is not only part of Torah law, it is of itself its own covenant. And covenant's not a contract. A covenant has a spiritual element to it that a contract does not. There is a depth to a covenant. It is so much more than an agreement among humans. See, I think of all the places in the Bible that sums up best exactly what's being said here, looks at this issue from both the earthly and the heavenly perspectives, it has to be Psalm, or rather Proverbs 2. I want us to read it all. So valuable is what it teaches us. All of the Proverbs is called wisdom literature. But little has so much wisdom condensed into so few words as this Proverbs. Proverbs 2. Starting at verse 1. My son, if you will receive my words and store my commands inside you, paying attention to wisdom, inclining your mind towards understanding. Yes, if you will call for insight, raise your voice for discernment. If you seek it as though you would silver, search for it as hidden treasure. Then you will understand the fear of Yehovah and find knowledge of God. For Yehovah gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He stores up common sense for the upright, as a shield to those whose conduct is blameless, in order to guard the courses of justice and preserve the way of those faithful to him. Then you will understand righteousness, justice, fairness, every good path. For wisdom will enter your heart. Knowledge will be enjoyable to you. Discretion will watch over you, and discernment will guard you. They will save you from the way of the evil, from those who speak deceitfully, who leave the paths of honesty to walk the ways of darkness, who delight in doing evil and take joy in being stubbornly deceitful, from those whose tracks are twisted, whose paths are perverse. They will save you from a woman who's a stranger, from a loose woman with smooth talk, who abandons the ruler she had in her youth, forgets the covenant of her God. Her house is slinking towards death. Her paths lead to the dead. None who go to her return, they never again regain the path to life. Thus you will walk on the way of good people and keep to the paths of the righteous. For the upright will live in the land, the pure-hearted will remain there, but the wicked will be cut off from the land, the unfaithful rooted out of it. Malachi says of the wrongly divorced woman, she's the wife of your youth, your companion, the wife of your covenant. Solomon spoke in similar terms of her in Proverbs 5, 15 through 23. Drink the water from your own cistern. Fresh water from your own well. Let what your springs produce be dispersed outside, streams of water flowing in the streets, but let them be for you alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain, the wife of your youth, be blessed. Find joy in her. A lovely deer, a graceful fawn, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Always be infatuated with her love. My son, why be infatuated with an unknown woman? Why embrace the body of a loose woman? For Yehovah is watching a man's ways. He surveys all of his paths. A wicked person's own crimes will trap him. He will be held fast by the ropes of his sin. He will die from lack of discipline. The magnitude of his folly will make him totter and fall. God hates divorce. There's no way around it. Yet because he knows humans so well, He has made laws and rulings to govern both marriage and divorce. See, what's interesting, if one thinks about it, is that Malachi and Solomon approach the issue as much from a wisdom standpoint as a legal standpoint. It's unwise for a man to put away a good wife for no good reason other than he wants a new and different one. In Bible times, in that region of the world, a divorce was purely in the hands of the husband. But wisdom says it's far better to feel greatly blessed by a good wife, despite being seduced by an unknown female. Why go that route? It's almost certain to result in disaster and heartache for everyone involved, but even more, God sees. It's a wicked man that does this, regardless of what that man may think. See, it's not my intention to turn this into a lesson about divorce, but neither can I leave it without saying. Because the Western world has put women on a much more equal path with men than we rightfully can have. The wife is one who might leave the marriage covenant wrongly, as much as the husband. The Apostle Paul also addresses the matter, mostly reiterating previously written biblical thoughts about divorce by saying that if either party breaks faith with the other, then yes, that is grounds for divorce that is not viewed as sin for the grieved and otherwise faithful party. Neither can I sugarcoat it. The modern view of no-fault divorce and claiming irreconcilable differences, meaning I just don't wish to be married any longer, might be fine in a secular environment if a covenant of marriage before God isn't involved. But it doesn't fly with God if you took vows in His name. Then it moves from being unwise to breaking His laws and commands, sin. All right, let's move on to verse 15. And hasn't He made them one flesh in order to have spiritual blood relatives? For what the one flesh seeks is a seed from God. Therefore, take heed to your spirit and don't break faith with the wife of your youth. Now, as difficult to interpret as Malachi chapter 2 overall, verse 15, at least first half of it, is the most enigmatic of it all. Nearly every Bible translation has a different take on it. Sometimes the words given are so senseless, it's like somebody dropped a Scrabble game, and the letters just kind of landed and assembled themselves however they randomly did. As J.M.P. Smith once said, this verse is hopelessly obscure. How then shall we approach this? Well, my thinking is, that provided this verse 15 and really the remainder of Malachi chapter 2 is legitimate and were actually there from the beginning, even if they may have become somewhat corrupted in their copying, then it is most legitimate to say that to whatever lengths we go to interpret it, it must align with the context and spirit of all that has come before it and will appear after it in Malachi's small book. The first words in Hebrew are Welo Achad Asah. And these words are presented, according to the biblical Hebrew scholars, in a most rare grammatical form. We, say ve, can mean and or but. Lo is just a negative that means no, non, not. Achad is most generally used to mean the number one. Now, the way it is used in a sentence can mean literally the numerical one, or one in a sense of something organically joined together, or meaning a union. The word asah is usually interpreted as either make or do, sometimes even create. The placement of echad makes the meaning ambiguous. In a nutshell, Either it was intended that the lo, no or not, is meant to modify echad, or echad is meant to modify asah, make or do. The result? The JPS Bible translation says, and not one hath done so, but using the other word association produces, has not the one God made. Two very different meanings, yet both quite legitimate. Now, we're not going to go through the remainder of the verse in this technical fashion. I just wanted to show you what it is about this verse that makes it nearly beyond any confident way to interpret it that I can stand up for. In the end, I agree with Andrew E. Hill when he says, whatever the exact meaning of verse 15, the treachery and faithfulness of divorce as practiced in post-exilic Yehud stands diametrically opposed, opposite the legacy of the covenantal oneness and faithfulness that Israel has received from Yahweh. To paraphrase Hill, the point of this verse is that God, in his unity with Israel, his unyielding faithfulness to the covenant that binds them together, was supposed to be how Israel not only responded in reciprocal love to God, but also how Israel responded together, human to human, within their believing community. Further, it should be exemplified, even beyond a general community oneness, to a virtual one flesh type of oneness in the covenant of marriage. Thus, divorce is terrible, even for legitimate reasons. But for a Hebrew man to divorce his faithful Hebrew wife in order to join himself to a pagan woman who worships a false god, is off the charts in magnitude. It's called an abomination. Now, one of the most important takes that we must accept in this passage is that while God may remove himself for periods of time from Israel in the sense that he won't protect and bless them, never will he renounce his faithful covenant relationship with them. How quickly his presence and blessing returns, depends solely on how quickly Israel learns its lesson, repents, returns to him in obedience and sincere faithfulness. Now, I say this with utmost passion and determination because the Constantinian church has turned this completely on its head. The church says God's divorced Israel. Israel means nothing to him now or forever, and the Gentile church is God's new wife. This is a lie straight from Satan himself. It overturns the Bible, Old and New Testaments. If you've been following along with Torah class, as we study the minor prophets in depth, this fact repeats again and again and again. Verse 16 says, for I hate divorce, says Yehovah, the God of Israel, and him who covers his clothing with violence, says Yehovah Zevot. Therefore, take heed to your spirit. Don't break faith. The first word of this verse is ki in Hebrew. It is what is called in the causal form, meaning that what has come just before this word, that is verse 15, happened because of what it said following the word ki. Thus, God says what he said in verse 15, due to the cause, I hate divorce. So yes, God can hate, as we've seen before in the prophets. And yet, when we read this in Deuteronomy 24:1, suppose a man marries a woman and consummates that marriage, but later finds her displeasing because he found her offensive in some respect. He writes her a divorce document, gives it to her, and sends her away from his house. The next several verses of Deuteronomy 24 spell out a number of terms about what is to occur in a divorce. That is, this isn't about God saying that divorce is to be expected, that he accepts it. Rather, as omniscient God, he knows it will happen in Israel. And so for the protection of the women and the children, he erects some guardrails without strictly forbidding divorce itself. In fact, what seems to be happening in Malachi is that we have Hebrew husbands divorcing in a technically legal way, as opposed to just throwing your wives out of the house without a get, a writ of divorce. Yehud was like a cancer patient at this time, and the cancer was rampant divorce. Next, we get to the statement about violence and garments. The Hebrew word used is hamas, and it is usually translated as violence. And yes, there is a direct association between this Hebraic word and the Arabic word, hamas, for which the terror group Hamas has adopted its name. While the Hebrew hamas leans towards meaning violence and evildoing, the Arabic hamas leans towards meaning zeal or enthusiasm. However, the Arabic hamas means zeal or enthusiasm in the sense of zeal to punish non-Muslims and enthusiasm to make war on non-Muslim nations. So what has violence to do with one's garment? A garment, clothing, is designed to cover a person's nakedness, but it is also an expression that is sometimes used to describe covering a person with their inner self, or condition, attributes. See, thus a garment could euphemistically be a garment of righteousness, or wickedness, or in this case, of violence, as indicating that inner condition. We read a much earlier story in the Bible where the term garment, lebusho in Hebrew, is employed, where Boaz is urged to spread his garment over the Moabite woman, Ruth. So here in Malachi, the husband who covers with his garment of violence is referring to the divorcing husband. He's acting in a terrible, unjust way towards his wife. Instead of covering her with a wedded garment of protection and trust, he's covering her in a garment of hostility. Now, please also note that in the notice of God hating divorce, he says he also hates the husband who does this. Do not confuse this with the human notion of hate as meaning a severe psychological dislike. As concerns God, it has to be looked at more in a political sense, that is, one of allegiance and acceptance. So for God to hate a person means to reject that person, to exclude them. And I want to sum up today's lesson in this way. While God condemned divorce, he didn't outright prohibit it. From the human-to-human interaction standpoint, God created some rules to control divorce from the sense of a proper and fair process. From the divine standpoint, divorce was a breakdown in covenant obligation between both God and man and man. But from the historical aspect, as concerned the condition of Yehud at the time of Malachi, it was an attempt to stop the chaos, build some stability in the Jewish community of Yehud that the rampant divorce of Hebrew women was causing, and equally as serious, the importation of idolatry caused by those same Hebrew men marrying foreign women. The only remedy is to restore the proper approach of the Jews to the long-standing covenant relationship Israel has had with Yahweh. We'll end it here and not finish with verse 17, since verse 17, it really ought to be the first verse of chapter 3, as it is the beginning of the fourth oracle of judgment, not the final verse of the third oracle of judgment. Okay?